actually, Sal, because meeting management, I think, is a critically important part of how to do this job as a CEO, right? Because it can get out of control. And I know people that habitually go back to back to back to back Zoom meetings, 15, 30 minutes at a shot. And it's like literally doing a dozen of them a day.
Yeah.
And I don't think that can be possibly good for you. Like, yeah, your brain must be fried.
Let's talk about it. I definitely agree it's not good for you. Sometimes I come away from days like that thinking, yeah, that can't be good. However, sometimes you do think, you know what? Maybe if I look back on the week, actually, we have moved the ball forward, because then you sort of get these inflection points that you can then delegate to the team. And actually, that is the cold face thing you need to do as a CEO, especially if you're sort of trying to spread the word and things like this. Then that's just the reality. And it means you drop a few other things, but it might be the right thing to do.
That's really interesting. And it's good that you put some thought into that. So we'll get into that conversation in a minute. We're live, everybody. So welcome to Founders Focus. It's episode 23. I say it every time now, but this is turning into the favorite thing for me to do. And the reason why is I think I learned so much from speaking to people that have been so annoyed about the problems in recruiting that they have gone ahead and try to set up a business, try and solve it, which, you know, to all intents and purposes is like a fundamentally like irrational thing to do. You know, most people will complain about recruiting and then just get on with the rest of their day. But no, this series is talking to people that have actually set up companies and are trying to fix this problem in a more fundamental sense. So it's been a fascinating journey so far. I'm pleased to introduce a person who I've met, I think, several years ago now, and wonderful to see this journey. It's Sahil Majos, CEO of MetaView. Sahil, welcome to Founders Focus.
Thanks very much for having me, Hom.
Great to see you, man. I mean, we were talking straight away about how busy you are in terms of meetings. Let's just like dive straight into this. What's your view? So you've kind of come to the point where you're thinking, yes, it's hard, but actually it's useful, because then you can see you've got more context and then you can start like pushing work in the right places for your business. How did you come up with that idea? Because most people reflecting on this would say, that's too much work, Sal. Stop doing this.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a spectrum. If I rewind, I definitely wouldn't have said that, let's say a year ago, when it felt like we spent a long time really getting the product right and making sure we were solving real problems for customers. And that's like focus work. And definitely you get your head above ground to speak with customers to inform the focus work so that you have high leverage focus work. But now we're at a point where we feel like we have a pretty good harness on what we're building, why it's important, who it impacts, and in what way. And so now now we've got a much larger team as well. So we have people who can specialize in certain areas. So I now ask myself, well, what am I uniquely positioned to do? Or where can I offer really differentiated value, even just internally to MetaView, to our team? Where can I offer differentiated value? And it's actually in conversations. It's even conversations like this, right? You have a series on founder focus, not on, you know, other people in the company focus. So there are just some conversations that as a founder or a CEO, you're uniquely positioned to have high impact on. I think that's things like marketing. That's things like meeting with senior buyers at customers. That's things like interviewing candidates. These are all require these human touch points. And so I do increasingly, even though it does result in a bit of a brain fry, look at if I can look at my calendar and chock a block with meetings, and I feel like I'm uniquely positioned to be, you know, the best person to be attending that meeting, and then that's a good thing.
That's actually a really wonderful term to use, a differentiated value, right? So, I mean, I would say even that applies to any type of person or any kind of role you have, but particularly for CEO, because the worst thing you can do is to do something that is valuable, but you know what? Another person could do this. And
far better than me. Most. I know that sounds like a bit sort of cliche, but it is, seeing it recently, it's just a 100% true. It's impossible as this... The unique perspective you have is, you see everything and you spend a lot of time thinking about the market as a whole, but it does render you very unlikely to be the best person to do any one of those things within that. So yeah, completely.
That's it. So you're super generalist. And the problem, I think, with all human beings generally is that you end up leaning on the stuff that you enjoy to do. There are certain things that you are quite good at, even though, you know, as a CEO, you're broad, but there's stuff that you definitely know how to do. And I've noticed that actually CEOs end up leaning into those things a bit more and, you know, trying not to do the stuff that's, you know, that they don't want to do, and end up sort of changing their role away from the generalist ideal into something that is kind of a generalist, but there's also like heavy lean towards certain areas. Is that something you're conscious of, Sile? And do you think that is okay? I mean, maybe it is okay, I guess. I mean, what's your thoughts?
I think it's, again, it's a bit of a spectrum. I think, so my background and my strength, I would say, is in, broadly speaking, product thinking. So thinking, how can, usually a piece of software help someone achieve better leverage, better outcomes, better enjoyment, whatever it might be. So I feel like I'm pretty good at thinking through those things. The reality is we've created a company, and that's like the culture of the company is to think like that. And so I don't just spend all my time thinking like that, but I am pretty sensitive to creating a culture where that is a sort of a thought process that is common in a lot of the folks that join the company. So while I don't spend a ton of time on things that I'm like clearly weak at, you know, like for example, if we want to really get a thorough, I've always done data analysis through my career, but it's never been something where, hey, if you want to get to sort of the best report for this customer, then Sile's the man for the job. But that's not necessarily, I'm maybe better at asking the question. So there'd be no point in me spending time there. So I definitely don't want to spend time where I'm weak, which are places where other people are really strong. But equally, if the facet of your characteristic that is strong is something that is central to the company, you also don't want to be spending time completely doing that. So I think it's pretty much somewhere in the middle.
Maybe that's actually the first scaling challenge of a CEO, isn't it? Where you identify your own qualities that are strong, I mean, which are strong because you've brought it from nothing to a point where it's a business, leveraging those strengths, but then you've got to scale it out. It can't just be you doing it. You've got to find the people that are really good at this so that you can train them and coach them and align them in that direction and then get them moving. So the CEO, I think a lot of people, again, I'm just like crystallizing this just from speaking with you, Sile, but it's you got to create the product, but then you got to create the company that creates the product. And those are two different acts of creation, if you like.
Just to put a finer point in it, the product is my comfort zone. Sales and marketing is not. It's sales and marketing are similar to product, and it's very easy to have an opinion on those things, but actually knowing what it takes to do great sales, do great marketing, do great product is a very different thing. I've been spending all my time on really sales and marketing for the last couple of years. So yeah, definitely not the thing that I would, you know, once I plunk my bum in the seat and sort of get to work, I'm thinking, okay, I'm in my actually absolute zone of genius here. Definitely where the company needed me to spend the time, and again, where I'm uniquely positioned to hopefully bring value to the table.
Yeah, and that's what CEOing is. It's basically being able to understand it's almost the ultimate team player role, isn't it? Because you understand what's required. It's almost like it's a glamour position from outside in, because you think, oh, there's the CEO, there's the headliner, etc. But I see it more like the James Milner type player in the football team. If anybody knows football, James Milner, very famous Liverpool player. But he's kind of like hard to categorize like what he does or what role he plays. Because the truth is, his job is to simply see where the problems are and just go there and try and fix that and make sure the team is a complete and efficient unit. And he's one of those players that obviously people in the know really rate him. He's not particularly like a headliner these days, but almost every pro in the game just has him right up there as someone who they deeply respect for what he does. So... yeah, it's the ultimate team player.
I actually think another like pretty like typical piece of advice that CEOs definitely hear, I'm sure like people hear it more generally as well, is there's usually a temptation to, hey, I know nothing about sales, I know nothing about marketing, let's go and hire a sales and marketing person. Now we are now at the point where we have hired these people, but actually you're more likely to make hiring mistakes if you have no no understanding at all of what it's like to walk a mile in those shoes, or no understanding of what the unique marketing or sales challenges that you're facing as an organization are. If you went and straight up just hire those people from the get-go, you actually miss out. I think there's a go slow to go fast element here, where learning the terrain, rather than just sort of having a view of, okay, well, it looks like we need to do some sales, but actually understanding the terrain yourself puts you in a much better position to hire the people who can then go on to do a better job than you. Whereas I think just hiring people straight up before you sort of try and crack it yourself is a bit of an abdication. So the knock-on consequence of that is you are constantly going to things that you haven't done before, because you know, okay, this is a really important part of the business now. Someone who, you know, one of the co-founders of the company in our case needs to go and own that problem for at least 3 to 6 months, and then work out the plan for scaling that. So we're constantly moving to things that are, yeah, outside of our wheelhouse.
That's really, that's just fantastic training. It's basically to, as you say, you almost concede that you might not have the optimal performance in that period of learning, but as the founder of the company, you can't have that as a knowledge gap. You can't have that as simply a book learned thing. You need to have really just imbibed it and got it into your pores to understand how it is to sell this particular product. And that helps you. Go ahead.
I draw the line. I'd say, though, there probably is a line. There's core competencies of the organization. We are building a unique and proprietary and differentiated product. That's a core competency of what we do. I think in a category creation motion, which is what we have, sales and marketing, same thing. It's actually a proprietary sales process, a proprietary marketing process. Not only me too, especially as we're sort of first products of this category. So we're learning all of these things from first principles. It's probably less true for other parts of the business over time, like, you know, maybe our finance and whatnot. I probably won't go in and like own that myself, because that feels a little bit more meta view agnostic. But I think for those things that are core competency, where you're differentiating, it's really important.
You know, again, you're saying some really interesting things, Sahil. Every answer you give just wants me to fork off into a different direction. But absolutely, what are the unique sort of areas of your business? You're totally right. Like FDE, finance, that's pretty much, I mean, it's into the world of complete structure. There's no real kind of sense that, you know, it's a very predictable type of thing you're looking for. Yeah, you don't need to learn this. But if you're doing something fairly unique or at least new in that space, then it's something that is underexplored. And the first thing you need to do is to explore it. I just wonder, folks, I mean, just imagine that as a recruiter. We often recruit people with no understanding of the roles that we're recruiting for. Maybe a one-hour brief from the hiring manager. It's typical. That would be good if we got that. Most of the time, you're just charging ahead with very little knowledge. But imagine how much more competent you might be if actually you did that job for a period of time. Not to say this is a practical thing to do, but just imagine your skill and your fluency in conversation and also assessment if you actually perform that role for a period. You would be much more confident in your ability to assess for talent if you'd actually done a little bit of that work. And by the way, I do know a few tech recruiters that do go on coding courses and do actually try and hammer out some crappy apps. I'm sure they're crappy, by the way, so don't feel too bad.
It doesn't have to be crappy. You don't have to hammer out a crappy app. You can try and make a good one, obviously.
You can try and make a good one, but I'm just guessing. Chances are a recruiter making off of Bootcamp is going to make a pretty crappy app in the first instance. But the true value, of course, is to learn what it is to make something like that and learn the psychology and what it takes to get there. And you know what? You're going to be much better as a recruiter as a result. So maybe it is a piece of advice for people that, let's say, are dedicated to recruiting a certain vertical, like give that job a go for a bit, you know?
Yeah. I think there's also the pressure from the other direction, which is people who are practitioners moving into recruiting. So there are numerous recruiting agencies I'm seeing now who are, you know, people who were salespeople and are doing sales recruiting. Or if you look at things like TripleByte, for example, that's, you know, it's essentially in many ways a recruiting agency, but it's engineers who are recruiting for engineers. So I think there'll always be multiple flavors, but I think there is also the sort of the other direction of pressure where practitioners becoming more focused on building teams, which actually is one of the things is a real tailwind for us, actually, is as per MetaView, is this sense that a lot of the practitioners, like the leaders, whether you're in engineering, sales, marketing, whatever, increasingly over time, their job becomes about building teams. And so they end up obsessing, it's exactly the story that we had of why we started the company. They end up obsessing over that just as much. And essentially the boundary between, you know, the VP of engineering and head of recruiting for tech is like, they're almost like the closest consigliere. They're working closer than anyone in the company together, because they are essentially working on the same thing. I think you see that in a couple of parts of the way the world is moving.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Let's jump into a time machine for a second, Sahil. Go back in time. Looking at your resume, your CV, like you're a winner if the world was like hiring in a credentialist way, right? Because you've got such a blue chip CV. It's like, yes, I want to hire this guy. He's perfect. So take me through all of this. You kind of went to UCL. You went straight in and you just got straight into doing product, didn't you, for tech? Like, how did that happen? And why was that a driver? Was it always like building stuff that was the thing that you're interested in?
No. I completely lucked out. So I was at UCL, as you mentioned. I studied history and was literally accepted into law school, was about to go to law school, but had a few conversations with some people who were a year ahead of me. So we're studying law at the law conversion at the time. This is obviously going back a while now, and just other people, and felt like I was not really committed to that track. That was an assumed career path for me for the longest time. I felt like I knew very little actually about the world of business and technology at the time, for sure. Both my parents worked for the NHS, so like there wasn't a lot of context I got around the world outside of that. And so just decided to take a year to see what else was out there, knowing that essentially I could always come back to go to law school the next year, because it was I could defer the entry. But after I did that, I sort of, within a few months, that was in the rearview mirror. I wasn't even thinking about that anymore. Just lucked out with joining Betfair, which at the time was pre-IPO, one of the first internet success stories really for the UK tech scene. The product director there, who went on to become chief people officer, was one of the people who he was giving up some of his time to get involved in the graduate intake recruitment. And so I had that connection with him during the interviewing, ended up working in product. I was actually a little bit like, I don't want to work in product. I've never heard of product. I don't know what product is at the time. And then things went from there. Super lucky, almost against my better judgment, ended up in a part of the tech world that I'm truly passionate about, which is making people's life better by using technology, which is really what product is at the central.
You say it's just luck, Sahil, but something told you to investigate the career path that you had been on this track. By the way, very classic. If you're going to go study English, history, whatever, that you're going to be a lawyer. That's the journey. And it reminds me a lot even of my own journey, as I was like doing social sciences at university all the way through A-level. Pretty obvious. I thought, yeah, only accountant maybe, or, you know, something like this. And again, looking back on it, it's like, thank God that didn't happen. But it could easily have happened. I'm interested to explore like what caused you to investigate. Was there something like in your sort of water, if you like, where you thought, you know what does this actually mean? And sometimes that voice is hard to listen to, because all of the direction, all the expectation, all of the things that you've externalized in your journey as in academia was, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer. So how did you make the decision? No, I mean, that I think is quite hard to do. Basically, I'm saying a lot of people don't make that decision, actually go ahead and fulfill.
I think there's two things. One is, let's not give me too much credit here. I was in a privileged situation, essentially, where I could think, hey, you know, I'm not going to go to law school this year. I'm going to see what I can find out there. Not everyone can make decisions like that. So I had I did have a certain amount of freedom to do that. At the time I was, 21. So there's definitely a privilege I had to be able to do that exploration without like clear idea of what I was going to be doing. So let's sort of like couch it in that for sure. And then I think once I was talking specifically about Betfair, had a lot of Silicon Valley influence. I was surrounded by people who I perceived as smarter than me, passionate about technology. There was just so much in the environment that I don't think I really thought about it much. Like, it was a micro environment and I thought, hey, I really enjoy it here and I want to get just as knowledgeable and just as expert, just as passionate, just as impactful as some of the people I'm surrounded by. And from that point on, it sort of becomes a little bit more blinkered. It's like you're doing that. And again, occasionally you lift your head up again and like, okay, well, what am I building my career towards? But I was going from such a state of, I was going from such a blank canvas of knowing what I wanted to do, because it wasn't going to be law anymore. So it could be anything, that sort of, I really just sort of head down, sort of committed to that path, and then sort of lifted my head up 3 or 4 years later, really.
You know what? That's actually, you've introduced yet another interesting dimension, which is the sense of like the inspiration and the energy you get from being in office with these people actually had a life-changing effect. I mean, basically, you wonder, right? Just imagine you did take the year and in fact, we're in the world of remote only, and you were just given a few things over Slack to do as part of your internship or your first entry job or whatnot. Probably the law would loom larger in as a choice, right? It would be the more obvious thing. So it does like have implications there. Like how do we make sure these opportunities become more real, and how do we make sure we have that type of unstructured information transfer that occurs in a buzzy environment and not lose that simply because it's a little bit more comfortable to be remote? It's a fascinating thing to think about, but we don't have time to dive into it entirely now, but we'll something to revisit for sure. Product, you did product in Betfair, you would end up doing product in lots of companies, into Uber and stuff like this. Some people would say product is ideal grounding to launch something at some point. Did you get that sense? And then when did you have the feeling that, okay, I want to be my own entrepreneur at some point, I'm going to do this?
Betfair is getting a lot of shine it was really transformative time for sure, because it was my entry point really into thinking about technology. But one project I did there was basically looking into potential acquisition options for the company as we were trying to move into social gaming at the time. So this is the time when things like Zynga were coming through, and they were like really big companies, and building games on Facebook was interesting. To maybe it still is, I don't know. I don't really watch that space. Anyway, point is, I became an absolute spectator, like huge fan of reading up about who's getting funding, where, who's starting what company, what's it trying to do, why is that new, what's that angle that makes that interesting, why was this possible now and before. So, like, as I've almost felt like I was a spectator. Startups for me were a bit of a spectator sport for like a long time, and at some point I thought to myself that I need to get out of the bleachers here, get off the spectator seat, and actually do this, because I was very passionate about it. And again, I was in a position where I could justify that I have a good chance of being successful in this realm here. So I was always into the idea of, well, not always, after the sort of those experiences, I was into the idea of potentially doing a startup at some point. The thing that was really clarifying, the thing that really catalyzed things for a long time, that was just like a humdrum background, you know, sometimes having spikes of energy towards throwing around ideas with friends or something like this, but not something I was making a concerted effort on. The big change for me was joining my first startup. So joined a fintech company just after it's raised its Series A, being exposed to what that actually looks like inside of one, and being exposed to people, technologists who are truly entrepreneurial and wanted the same thing. And then obviously, when you start to be surrounded by that type of energy, those type of people, then it becomes much more of something that you can take steps towards. Sharia, who's the other co-founder of MetaView, I met him at this Series A company. He went on to be an engineer at Palantir when I went on to work on products at Uber. So we had these sort of big US tech scale-up experiences, which is really where we saw the actual challenge that we wanted to take on, which is these hiring challenges. I think it was a mix of knowing there were people who were inclined in the same direction as me, who, well, not even people, person. That's what it takes, right? It's meeting that one or two people who you want to start a company with. That really made it, really accelerated things.
Yeah, I think sometimes it does take a partner, right? I mean, a lot of us have the idea, but to translate the idea into action, I mean, I totally appreciate the person who can do everything solo, and you do know some of those folks as well. But most product-based companies have started from 2-3 people that have got together and thought, okay, let's do this together. And again, it's like, is that even possible in a remote world? You know, you wonder whether the social capital or the relationships would be built enough. Has there been enough exchange for that relationship to actually both jump in this way? So interesting to see how startups will emerge in a more global role.
I think it will find its way, won't it? Like it's like water will find all of the cracks in your roof or in your house. I think entrepreneurs will find a way to make it work in whatever context they're in. I have confidence.
It might just be a different way of doing it, like a more decentralized way. I mean, I was just speaking to a founder, a friend of mine, who obviously is into Web3 and stuff like this. And yeah, I'm sure there'll be ideas emerging from a super decentralized, like decentralized by design type of structure of a business that will start sort of creating opportunities for new things to butt off. So scale up was a big issue at these big invested companies, hiring. You were doing a lot of hiring. Your partner was doing a lot of hiring. When did the idea of MetaView start sort of becoming a thing in your mind? Was there a moment, or was there an interview, or was there like a particular thing where you thought, why don't I have this?
There was a real catalyzing moment where we sort of honed in on, I would say, the vision of MetaView, but there were a series of events before that sort of played into that moment, if you know what I mean. So where we had this sort of jam session, really, where we started to think about some things. The couple of things for me, when I actually got interviews at Uber, Uber had this concept of a bar raiser process. So essentially, anyone who gets hired at Uber at the time, I don't know if they still do it, would be interviewed by someone who had this moniker of a bar raiser. It was sort of like invented at Amazon, the idea that there's a small population of people who are sort of bastions of the culture of the company, and they have to be a yes on this candidate for the person to get hired. So I was like all amped up for this interview, thinking, okay, this is the big one. If I impress them here, then I'll definitely get the job. And it wasn't the strongest of the interviews that I did, like anywhere near it. And it made you question, well, okay, so what is it that makes someone a bar raiser? And now looking back, I sort of know, well, it's just like, you know, politics. That person probably asked to be a bar raiser at some point, and you know, this sort of thing. And the person had no reason to say no. It's not actually based on data. There's no data that's telling us this person is the best at picking people for the company. It's just something that someone had in their personal performance plan, and therefore they wanted to do it. So that was one. The other was we had this, I was working on driver products at Uber. So not the rider app that maybe most of the people that are listening in might be familiar with, but the driver application one they have, you know, when they're driving the car, the one that they have on their sort of heads-up display. And it was actually, I was at Uber at a time when it had a lot of reputational damage for various reasons, partially due to the internal culture, partially due to the perceived treatment of drivers. So we had this wartime scenario with drivers, like, okay, we need to pull a lot of stuff out of the bag to make sure drivers are happy with working driving for Uber, because they were churning. And so we flipped our operating model as a company. Like, this was a decision way above my head, where we went from what we used to do, which was bottoms up objective setting, to saying, hey, we're the driver payments team, we're going to work on these things, to top down. And the people at the top of the organization said, these are the things we're doing for drivers, and here are the owners of each of these names. And all it was a big G sheet with, I think it was about 20 projects on it. And it had who was owning it from a product perspective, who was owning it from an engineering perspective, and that's it. Like, get on with it. This is the situation. And first thing I did when we saw that spreadsheet, I was one of the Big Rock owners, it was called, was look through the rest of the projects and look through who the owners are. And really, that was how you were judging, do I think this is going to be successful or not? It's the people. So for me, that was a real penny drop moment, like, oh my God, Uber has this incredible opportunity to become, you know, at the time, we thought just, you know, one of the biggest companies ever. And it's going to come down to these human beings' ability to succeed against plan. And for me, that was a really penny drop moment for me, where I actually started, I'd always academically understood, hey, who you hire is incredibly important. But that was the moment where the penny dropped for me, of like, Oh, so those decisions we've made months and over the last few years about who's in the company are actually going to determine do we meet our potential or not.
You know what? That's just a fascinating document. I wonder whether anybody still has some sort of copy of it. Not to say we should publish it, but imagine, obviously, a crisis moment, a turnaround moment, big change in terms of how things are going to happen. Your name features on there, and then you're thinking, oh, crap, pressure on. Who is in my boat with me as we're trying to row through the rapids here? And you're starting to look through all the names, who are the strong engineers, who are the great product people, all those types of things. Wow, that's like I can totally understand why that would be like a very significant moment in someone's thinking. Yeah. Like, because your own sort of reputation, your own career is very much tied to the people that you're working with and vice versa.
Yeah.
So, you know, you don't want to be in a situation with people who, you know, perhaps you don't think are up to mark in whatever way. And it would be very good to have some information about that other than reputation or, you know.
Yeah. Well, and then that sort of like, that was one of the moments that sort of when we were piecing through our experiences at these two companies, you then ask yourself the question, of course, okay, so why were we in a position where some of the folks' names on that spreadsheet were maybe not up to snuff on, were not appropriate, were not good fits for what they were being asked to do by the company? And so we had this phrase that we came up with, which was, how might we make it so that no bad hiring decisions are made again? This is like our big, hairy, audacious goal as a company. We'll never quite achieve it, and we just want to get closer and closer to achieving it over time. And our big takeaway was, well, I don't actually have the data that matters on my hiring process. So how can I even possibly begin to answer this? How can I possibly begin to make it so that no bad hiring decisions are made when I actually don't have the data that matters from my hiring process? And when you think about it, there's actually inflectional decisions across the talent lifecycle, from defining the role to actually making the hiring of the person, to deciding what teams they sit on, to either rewarding or promoting or firing that person. All of those decisions are incredibly high leverage, really inflectional decisions, both for that individual and for you as a company. And they're all made in a pretty opaque and subjective way, like every single one of them. So right now we're very focused. Our sort of immediate takeaway from why was that spreadsheet populated with people who weren't actually the right people to do the job as well? I can't help you fix your hiring because I don't understand the data from your hiring. What's the most important data about our hiring that we don't have access to? Well, from our experience as interviewers and hiring managers, which was in our opinion, and remains to be our opinion, that's really where the decision gets made on candidates. We don't have any of that data. So let's solve that data problem. For the last 4 years, we've been on a journey of solving that data problem and then working out what you do with that data to solve the problem. And we're pretty pumped about some of the ways that we're doing that now. But that was essentially the journey to founding the company.
This actually gives us into a really nice opportunity to describe to the people what MetaView is, because it is a new category. I would say, you know, most people would still have some confusion as to what it is. So tell us what it is, Sile. What do you do?
Yeah, so MetaView is an interview intelligence platform. We focus on recording and analyzing job interviews. So we're doing all of our interview conversations often within arm's reach of a camera and a microphone now, which makes it all of a sudden super easy to capture the actual conversation. And we analyze those interviews to help fundamentally with three things. One is help companies, high growth companies, grow their interviewer population in a very systematic and deliberate way. So it's not just a case of, hey, anyone who wants to interview can interview and off you go, hopefully you make the right decisions, but you actually are helping sort of create this pool of trusted interviewers in a very deliberate way, because everyone knows how everyone else is interviewing and they know what good looks like and they're receiving feedback and data on how they're interviewing. Secondly, we help people increase the calibration of their interviewers, so that one interviewer, if you have 10 interviewers who are all interviewing for engineering managers, they are all interviewing in similar enough ways to believe that your process is consistent, and they all have a similar enough understanding of what a good candidate looks like, that you're not just making it a coin flip. Like, the amount of times you come out of an interview, you have two people in that interview, one says yes, one says no. If you had a different person in that interview and they had said yes, you would have said yes to the candidate. You had a different person interviewing, they had said no, you would have said no. It's just a coin flip. There's no actual structure there. We help remedy that and really redress that balance so that all of your interviewers have a much more thorough understanding of what a good candidate looks like for your organization. And then the last thing is, and the really, really one of the key things is just ensuring quality and consistency over time. So we measure characteristics of interviews, like who's speaking and for how long. So do you have any interviewers who are really maybe dominating the conversation more when the candidate is of a certain background? Or we also measure how many questions, actual assessment questions, people ask you in interviews. So do you have some interviewers who, for certain candidates, that seem to be really rigorous, and for other candidates seem to be less rigorous? Or do you have teams where some of the interviewers in the team are really rigorous and some of the other interviewers are really, really lax with their interviews? And if so, you want to make that more consistent. So actually getting what we would consider almost from a product or engineering perspective, observability of this machine. And we think what's going to happen is people are going to increasingly think of the interview process as a product. And just as I have been used to, as a product manager, having incredible tooling for deploying new features and for measuring the impact of products and whatnot, people are going to have the same thing for their interview processes. And there's going to be increased accountability around that because of it, but also much better ability to impact the quality of the process because you actually have data about what's happening in there.
You know what? What a fantastic pitch and description that is, Sahil. First thing that you mentioned, I didn't actually clock. Understood it right here, which is the idea of increasing the interviewer population in a company. Like, imagine that, folks. You've got a load of people, but there's only a few in your employee population that you trust to interview. Now, wouldn't it be great if you could times two that? Because that suddenly means that you've got a lot more flexibility, a lot more interviewing capacity. So you can actually open up the pipeline a little bit. You can actually interview more people. Think what that means potentially for things like DE&I, for instance, and all those types of issues out there. So, you know, that could, you can see how this product might then scale to any number of, almost everyone who's in a business might be a user or someone who would get value from this because they would improve their interviewing capability. And of course, you know, as a person that wants to contribute to a business or even build career going forwards, probably it's a skill that you need to develop. Also, interview consistency. Again, I think we've always accepted that, yes, you know, it's going to be inconsistent, but we can't do anything about it. But now you've got a situation where the capture of the information and the analysis of it can actually give you a lot of, you can have numbers against what is going on. And that's the bottom line. You know, does Hung speak more than Sahil, for instance? I really hope this interview is being a meta view, by the way.
We should do that, actually. Well, I think we can download the recording afterwards and upload it on meta view.
Please do. I would love to actually understand a bit more about how this works because, you know, as an interviewer, my aim is obviously to try and ask the questions and get responses, but probably I speak too much. So these things are super interesting. Okay. New category, new idea. What was it like to go to market with this? Because whenever you're doing something new, almost all business, any business will tell you, look, you're not going to change anything by, you know, you're doing the hardest thing by trying to get people to change behavior and have a new concept. How was that like when you first birthed this idea and thought, right, I need to get people to try this?
The initial feedback, which was on a product that didn't really exist at the time, this is going back 4 years now. So like pre-COVID, you know, much of hiring still happening in person. So there's a number of ways that the product was a little bit different. But the fundamental sort of output that we were showing or expected output that a customer could have if they signed up with us, which was essentially our first MVP, was, hey, this is what you'd have if you signed up with us. And it was sort of like this prototype. People really leaned in. And when I say people, I mean recruiting leadership. So the first batch of people that we aimed to speak to were recruiting leaders. These were the people that we continue to have in our mind as the people accountable for the quality of interviews generally in an organization. And when we showed them our prototype dashboards, they really leaned in and wanted to know more. And that was enough for us to say, okay, happy that it makes a ton of sense to us. We had lots of friends in recruitment and this is how we got a lot of some of this feedback, but also, you know, got connected to folks outside of our immediate circle. Really wanted that validation that before we started building anything, that this really got people leaning in. So people, and I mean that in many cases, literally, like people thought they were doing us a favor by taking a meeting with us. But actually, when we started to get to the meat of the prototype, you know, you actually see people lean in, eyes widen, start to ask much more challenging questions about the product, which is usually a really good sign. So yeah, that was the thing that gave us the confidence, because we were pretty comfortable with our level of empathy for hiring managers and interviewers and how we could build a product that they really value, which is one of the really tough things about this category of product, is that the users, oftentimes recruiting leaders, are used to buying tools that are used by their recruiters. But this is a tool that is actually primarily going to be used by everyone else, by the hiring managers, by the interviewers. And so we felt, and continue to feel, very, very sort of confident about our understanding of sort of a day in the life of, for them. But what we needed up front was, okay, head of recruiting, they're going to be a key stakeholder here. Let's make sure we get their feel for what we're doing. And when that was positive, it was just all systems go, really.
Yeah, fantastic. And you're absolutely right. When you can see the animation that people have, the engagement, you show them stuff that they haven't seen before. And like I say, it's almost like revealing a problem that most people had accepted and receded into the sort of the background, because it was just considered that was how it was.
Yeah, yeah.
But suddenly we see this. And of course, with the shift of everything to remote, I think I would be amazed if, 90%+ of first stage interviews are not on video now. Idea of in-person interview.
Put that well beyond first stage. I think, even companies, even really large, some of them are our customers, large companies who are officially now hybrid operating model overall, actually have their recruiting process completely remote. Because what you don't want to do really is have a hybrid recruiting model, because you will inevitably end up favoring the people who are able, who you do end up meeting in person. So you end up being a little bit more binary with your recruiting process. And so, definitely in our data, it's much, much higher than 90%, even beyond the first stage interview.
You know what? That's, again, another interesting insight. The idea that you need to be 100% one way or the other when you're going to conducting an interview program, even if the person is next door and says, hey, I can just pop in. You can't have that person pop in because they may end up sort of, they will have a different experience and a different impact to the interviewers, and it may well be good or bad. That will change how that experience needs to be. It has to be completely disciplined. So I do totally see a situation where first, second stage interviews are entirely remote. Maybe the only time where it's in person is if the company or the job is going to be in person in the first instance, and it's maybe a significant enough move or a job for a person that it would make sense. Yeah. So I wouldn't quite say rubber stamp, but it's almost like, maybe it will be third or final stage before you go and have that appointment.
I think there's a couple of other variables. Another related variable to that is this a hiring machine, or is this like an exotic hire? If you're hiring a chief marketing officer, do what you want. You can make one of those hires like every few years, hopefully, and you're not trying to build a machine. You're just trying to get this one right. Whereas if you're hiring, hundreds of software engineers or hundreds of salespeople or whatever it might be, still really high bar for who you're hiring, but it's a machine, and you usually have a centralized view of what good looks like for this role. And we're hoping to hire hundreds of people who match that profile, and there you're building a machine. And that's where the data becomes much more relevant, and the systematicness of the process becomes much more important as well. One thing I would just throw in there as well, though, by the way, is we do have some interviews that are on the platform that are in person, and we started the company before remote was such the stand was the de facto way to do the vast majority of recruiting. Still with the thesis that more and more conversations are had within, I think I said at the start, they're had within arm's length of a camera. That is still true. Every modern company has meeting rooms that are equipped with cameras and microphones that are pretty high quality. So it's still the same. I think really what the move to remote done is accelerated, as is it's pretty, again, pretty cliche that everyone will talk about. It's accelerated a lot of these trends and it's accelerated a lot of these capabilities. But actually, it's still part of the same journey, which is, businesses are going to have microphones and cameras everywhere because it helps with their productivity. It helps with their efficiency. It's more inclusive for people if you do want to have some people who aren't on site. So there are all sorts of reasons why it makes sense.
Are there any product or platform-wide trends in terms of behavior of candidates or interviews that you found surprising? Like, you know, if you've processed X amount of interviews and you found, oh, this seems to happen a lot with this demographic of person, lad, we didn't know that, maybe we should. Any of those things that you could throw out at us, Sahil?
Oh, put me on the spot. It's also super hard to know what's surprising when I've been sort of looking at the data for such a long time now. We don't actually spend that much time analyzing candidate data as well, so that I'm drawing a little bit blank on candidates, because really MetaView is about understanding interview performance, like the interview process you're running as opposed to the candidates. We think that's the right impact. The biggest impact and the right impact to have is improve the quality of the process. So don't actually have lots on the candidate side of things.
And just on that, by the way, I think that also supports the privacy issue to a large degree, in the sense that the focus of the product is really on the users of the product, like the hiring managers and the recruiters, and the pitch to them is to say, this is going to be helping you. This is, in effect, a training tool that's going to help improve how you do things. And it's almost like a health analytics type of thing that you might have in order to improve your body, let's say. This is here to try and improve this particular part of what it is you're doing. Okay, very, very good, Sahil. Okay, so zooming back out again, having piloted this ship for, what, 4 and a bit years now, you must have like a pretty good sense of, you know, your own style as a CEO, as a business leader. What are the things you like about that style? And what are the things you think, you know what, that's a learning and development area for Sahil Majo, so I need to get better at that. How would you answer that question?
Yeah, as you mentioned, piloting the ship for a while, but vast majority of our growth has been in the last 18 months or so. There's like a window of that has been much more about leadership. I think before that, I hopefully still am a builder to some extent, but the sort of the first 3 years really, I was a builder, not a leader within the company necessarily. So the things that I think have developed as a leadership, as a company, we're very high on, even before we knew how to enable it, we're very high on accountability. So hiring people who seek accountability for things, which is not something that everyone does, not everyone wants that in their day-to-day life necessarily. But for our stage where we're, you know, building something that's really ambitious and really looking to make an impact on changing not only how our customers do things, but, you know, we hope we'll touch, you know, almost every knowledge worker, right, will end up going through interview processes where they have something like MetaView involved in that process, that is meaning that process is run more effectively. So it's really, really ambitious goal, and that I think just generally requires high accountability among people. So the big question for us from a leadership style is, okay, it's all very well and good saying you want people with this trait of accountability, which we do, but how do you actually enable accountability when things are changing so quickly? And it's very hard to make sure that the people who you're asking to be accountable for things, to make sure they actually have the same amount of information as you, is literally a challenge, because we're getting new information all the time. Leadership style, we've focused a lot on how to enable transparency within the company. And so I'd say that is something that is a plus in my personal leadership style, and I think leadership, other leaders within the company as well. That literally means making sure that we have meeting reports written up when we have important meetings with customers that everyone has access to. We're pretty hot on actually recording our sales calls, for example, as well. So even, you know, our product engineers and our customer success and our other salespeople have access to that conversation and can make their own inferences and develop their own intuition about what's important to customers. So really leaned into that transparency, along with the expectations that come with that. Like, hey, we're doing all this extra work to make sure that everyone in the company has just as much context as us as founders. With that becomes an expectation that you actually really have accountability for these decisions, and you make these decisions with this information in mind, you know, because there's a tax associated with us writing up these meeting reports and all these sorts of things. So I think that's like a good area where I feel pretty satisfied with what we're doing. I think the area for improvement has been I'm learning, I keep on learning that there is like no right answer, right? And I think that's probably true in life. Like, the world is way too complex to actually upfront try and work out the right answer to something when you're creating something new. But especially when you're in doing category creation, trying to work out the right answer upfront is just not worth the time. Like, there's a certain amount of confidence you need in a decision, at which point it becomes you should just do it, because you're never going to get to 100. You're getting diminishing returns on this research. So I think that's an area where now that we have more people who are essentially reliant on my decisions internally, an area where I could do better.
Very interesting, Sahil. I mean, again, both of those areas, super interesting. The transparency side, writing up meeting notes, like, that's actually a really, it's really important discipline, because it means that firstly, you've come to conclusions, that you've agreed the document, this is what happened in the conversation, but you've also made sure that everyone else has access to that, and it becomes an artifact that we can say, this is what we agreed. Whereas how many companies out there like don't do that? Like, almost all of them. You know, a bunch of people go away and have a meeting. Nobody knows what's happened in that meeting.
Yeah.
2 weeks down the line.
And that's why you get scenarios where leaders who do say, hey, I want to give my people autonomy, they don't contradict themselves, because they're actually lying when they said they wanted. Like, every leader wants their people to have autonomy because it makes their life easier as a leader. It's just, you have to actually do the work to give them the same amount of information as you have. Otherwise, you will always distrust their decisions, because you know, oh, they probably don't, they have like 30% knowledge that they don't have. And that just means that their decisions are never going to be as good as mine. So I have to get involved in this decision. So it also really pays dividends. We're onboarding a bunch of people this month, and it actually makes onboarding so much easier, because you're like, there's enough content within this company for you to just go and satiate your curiosity, and you'll be like pretty far along your ramp journey without having to like orchestrate this massive like tuition sort of schedule for you. So it pays back then as well.
There's a tipping point with transparency, I feel. Like, if you've gone from an opaque sort of environment where information is siloed and not moving around very easily, hard to find, even, you know, maybe even non-documented, you end up asking somebody to piece it together, firstly. So there's a job, there's effort. And secondly, there's a case where if the documentation is there, you end up having gatekeepers that then have to do the training and the onboarding and saying, this is how it all works. Whereas if you operate open right from the beginning and as default, you can just point people to it and say, look, this is what, if you look at this, you basically know what I know. And that then, the dividend then sort of comes goes out from there. So the effort to put in to open the door is what's going to unlock all of that efficiency that would otherwise be spent ferrying information backwards and forwards, basically. The second point you mentioned was about decision-making style, in the sense that, did I hear that correctly to say that you're potentially in the past, you were very much more like a due diligence type of thinker, you know, wanted to get all the information, wanted to make sure that, you know, every thing was covered to as much as percent as possible. But as time has moved on, things have speeded up, your time has reduced, you've had to lower the amount of information before you make decisions. So instead of 80%, you're going to have to go with 65%, because you know what, that'll do. Is that basically what you meant?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of variables. So the answer is yes, that is what I meant. There's a couple of things that one, right now we're a larger and better resource company than we were previously. So maybe it's just the context of the company that has changed, right? We can afford to do multiple things at a time. And therefore, the advantage you get as a company that's well resourced is you can take some of these swings, and you know, okay, well, there's all of these things can be successful. And that's absolutely fine, because that's the strategy we're allowed to take, because we're in a healthy situation from that perspective. But even then, I think the big thing that changed, even if I sort of went back in a time machine and sort of started the company again, would be the understanding the part of the equation that is your personal impact. I do actually think that we all, to sort of coin a bit of a Jobsian phrase, we are all putting a ding in the universe to some extent. And I think historically I was maybe responsible for underestimating the multiplier effect that you doing this can have. It's not like there's an answer. The world is not going to go a certain way and you're trying to predict which way it's going to go so that you can just be part of that wave. You are actually, there's a certain amount that for sure is determined by things way beyond, like the vast majority is determined by things way beyond your completely. Don't get me wrong, I'm not acting, I don't want to act like that's not the case. But there is within the sort of the currently small world in which each of us is operating, one of the variables in that is how is the impact that you have on the sort of the formation of that wave, let's say. And I think that when you're talking about a very new category, which we still really are, and hopefully there's, you know, butterfly flaps at wings and it becomes a massive thing at some point in the future, that's obviously what we're aiming for. But you know, meta usability, my personal ability to sort of affect the current course of that, the ripple effect is pretty darn high. And so you should also lean into that without just trying to predict how's the market going to go. How are you going to impact how the market's going to go becomes more of a thing. And to do that, you need to doing is like a really good way to start to understand the cause and effect.
Yeah, really interesting and important perspective. Like a lot of trend watchers, a lot of market watchers out there. I'm one of those people oftentimes, but don't forget, you are part of what you're observing.
Exactly.
And in fact, you do have action. You're not just a inert node in there. You know, in fact, there's not much that is inert in the universe. You know, we all interact in various ways. And as you say, that interaction doesn't stop often. You know, if you think about it on a physical level, something will happen and it will keep happening as it keeps rippling through the universe. So there's no question that concept, I think, is not only an important one for business, but maybe even one for your own personal sense of self-confidence, yeah. Because there may be moments where you feel like things are out of your control, things are tough, you know, it's chaotic out there or whatnot. But actually, yes, all that's true, but at the same time, you are still an active agent in this universe. Sal, moving towards the end of this interview, so I want to wrap up with a few more questions on this. MetaView, what exciting things might customers expect from you guys this year?
I think two things that are big priority for us. There's a part of our really sort of key and delightful part of our product, which is around giving interviewers personalized feedback. So to take one step back without going too deep necessarily, how do you help companies run better interviews? Well, at the end of the day, interviews are run by human beings. We call them interviewers in this context. So if you're going to run better interviews, you need to change the behavior of those people. Changing behavior of people is really tough, and like even small changes can be tough to achieve. We have a really effective way of helping change interviewers' behavior, which is through this personalized feedback, which is based on the data we put out in the interviews. So we're putting a lot of effort into making that feedback more timely. And actually more bite-sized. So what that would mean is interviewers at the right point in time getting the exact right piece of information or the exact right insight or the exact right suggestion that they need to run a better interview. That's like a really popular part of our product already, and there's some really awesome things we have in the pipeline to make that even better and more relevant to more interviewers on the platform. And then the second thing is we've always been very, very data driven, both in how we build the company, but actually in how we to use this, you know, to sort of like extend from what we were talking about previously, to move the market towards thinking more about the data from interviews. You know, that's not going to happen unless companies like MetaView exist and make it happen. And we were going to continue that journey. And so we have a lot of really cool ideas for reporting on the overall consistency and quality of interviews, which is a really really, really interesting nut to crack, because it's all working out what interview is supposed to be comparable to what interview, and if you do want to benchmark that against other companies, what can you actually compare it against? Which interview types are sort of the equivalent? There's a big data question essentially at the heart of that, which we're pretty pumped about our answers to, and are working on rolling out that reporting to predominantly with talent leaders being the customers of that initially, but very soon after that, functional leaders and hiring managers themselves, and then interviewers themselves as well.
You know what? That will be fascinating data. If you're in a situation that you could aggregate and get that out in some way, I think that the recruiting industry would lap it up. Has been like a big black. I mean, wouldn't you, folks? If you're watching this and you're thinking, "Oh, we could actually get some industry-wide information on how interviews are generally conducted, how long they are, how many questions are being asked." All of those things
right now, just to be clear, you can get that. It's just that the level of granularity will increase in how we provide it.
Are you talking? I was good. You might have even touched on something I was about to ask. Are you talking about sentiment analysis? I was thinking, what's the next stage for MetaView? Mm. Could this in some way eventually be able to detect those subtle hostilities, let's say, or subtle amity sometimes even, because people might have these reactions at a physical level or whatnot, and you just don't know. And you think, there's a residual hostility behind this questioning. We don't know why, but that's probably something that's worth knowing. Is that even possible to do, do you think, or is that beyond product?
Sentiment analysis on tone and transcript doesn't tend to be isn't at the moment incredibly accurate. And one of the things you want to be really sensitive with in everything that companies, ours and companies like ours do, is it's really punitive if you give bad information, bad insights. Like, you don't want to be doing that because interviewers have a lot of power. We are on the side of interviewers. We want to help interviewers. We definitely don't want to be penalizing people, especially definitely not erroneously penalizing interviewers. And same with candidates. If you apply that analysis to candidates and you're trying to impact the decision that's being made, you better be pretty sure about it. So our philosophy is very much around augmenting the interviewer or the talent leader, the hiring manager, whoever it is who's all of those stakeholders who are involved in making hires. And we haven't found a way at the moment where that sort of sentiment analysis really serves their needs in a really compelling way. So given the level of accuracy that you can achieve. We're not doing that. That's not something we're seeing as a high priority, both from our perspective or from our customers' perspective.
Yeah, it's a curio. I just wondered, maybe the way to do it might just be to do it via the transcription rather than through the recording itself, because you could do textual analysis on that, and maybe you could figure out at scale what is going on. But yeah, it's just something to chew the fat over at another time.
What I would the thing you do see is often what you'll obviously, part of MetaView's product involves recording the video, the transcript from interviews. In scenarios where you do have a candidate who say rejected an offer, you often get people who will want to review the game tape on this and understand what we did wrong. You still kick off those human interactions where people will say, hey, it felt like this was a little bit of a de-energized way to end the interview. Maybe we can work on that next time. So those human level things, like sentiment, that still happens, and having the game tape still enables that. The way I interpreted your question was more around the aggregate level analysis of aggregate level insights about the sentiment or the tone that is set by your interviewers is not top of the list for us, but it does happen by practitioners within the companies who use our products.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, Sal, we're coming to the end of this session. So thank you so much for your time. Final word to you. What kind of people should be thinking and using a product like MetaView? Who are those people and why should they use it?
So anyone who is obsessed with the quality of their teammates, the quality of their teams at a high growth modern company, those are who our customers are. Usually that means you're suffering from one of two problems. One is you've grown like crazy. You've grown like a weed for the last few years. You look around and now you're seeing that half the people who are running interviews, you don't even know. You don't even know who they are and how they're responsible for hiring the next batch of people. And you think, hey, is there a way that I can, without slowing down the ship, because speed is everything, is there a way that I can actually maintain and increase quality of interview over time? We're a really good solution for you. The other type of company you might be is one who is really considered and really did introduce a bottleneck to who was allowed to interview. And now you're starting to buckle under the pressure because you need to hit those hiring goals. You need more interviewers and you don't know how to make that happen without lowering the bar for interviewing. We can help you with that too. So if either of those two problems resonate, get in touch. LinkedIn, email is sile@metaview.ai. We'd be pumped to talk.
Fantastic. Sile, thank you so much for your time. What busy stuff do you have to do now? Have I made you late for your next back-to-back video call? Probably have, haven't I?
No, I think we're good. I have a regular slot in my calendar that says exercise that never gets used for exercise. It gets used as the overspill for all those things that I should have been doing. So yeah, we've got a board meeting on Tuesday and we're sort of buttoning down our Q2, some of the specifics of our Q2 plan. So I'll be doing that.
Go and do some push-ups, man. I think I agree with you. I'm going to try and do some exercise myself right now. Okay, Sam Ajos, great to have you on Founders Focus. Wonderful product. Wonderful to hear where you're going with this. And yeah, look forward to learning more about what you guys get up to. Thank you for joining us on the Founders Focus.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. Cheers, Sam.
Wasn't that great, folks? Really smart guy, really a lovely dude as well. And yeah, what an interesting category of business. I think certainly here's an opportunity for us to get information from what has always been a mystery part of our recruiting process. Okay, that is it for today. We're back on Brain Food Live this Friday. So if you're interested in this type of show or just having a conversational type of content, make sure you follow the channel for that. We are going to be talking on Friday about how to build social capital in a remote only world. So if you are thinking about, how do we actually build relationships, especially if you're starting new in your career or jumping to a new domain when everybody's working from remote, we've got a load of people who are on that journey now and are going to share some information with us. Okay, that's it, folks. I hope you've had a good show. Thanks for watching.